Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Islamic State militants kidnapped more than 150 students last June. The militants released most of the students several months later. We will have the story of one of the recently released students later in the program. But first, Mario Ritter brings us a report on the new cabinet of Indonesian President Joko Widodo.
Since the beginning of his political career, Joko Widodo has worked hard to separate himself from Indonesia's political leadership. Observers say they saw this quality in him even when he served as mayor of a small town. In his first week as Indonesian president, Mr. Widodo has sought to build on this political identity. Corruption is a serious issue in the country. In an unusual move, the president asked the country's anti-corruption agency to investigate nominees to his cabinet. That process led to delays and resulted in the removal of 8 ministerial candidates. 34 ministers in Mr. Widodo's working cabinet were announced on Sunday. A few hours later, they were sworn in at ceremonies in the official home of the president. The ministers promised to follow the law and reject bribes, unlawful attempts to influence their judgment. The cabinet includes technical experts, business people, and a few others credited with being reformers. Keith Lovard is with Concord Consulting, a company that advises businesses. He describes the cabinet appointments as a wait-and-see cabinet. The cabinet has several business leaders who are unproven in government. They include Susi Pudjiastuti, who owns an airline company. Joko Widodo has promised to reform government agencies and target an economic growth rate of 7%. A number of observers have praised the nomination of Pratikno as state secretary. He has served as the rector or head of Gajah Mada University in Yogyakarta. The president chose the rector at Paramadina University, Anis Baswadan, as the Minister of Primary and Secondary Education. Retno Lestari Priyansari Marsudi has been named Foreign Minister. She is the first Indonesian woman to hold the position. A career diplomat, she formerly served as ambassador to the Netherlands, Iceland, and Norway. She is one of 8 women in the new administration. But observers have criticized the number of political appointments to the cabinet. They were especially unhappy with appointments of people close to former President Megawati Sukarnoputri. Siti Zuro is with the Indonesian Institute of Sciences. She says the cabinet appointments show that Mr. Widodo is not completely independent. Throughout his political campaign, Mr. Widodo has said he would not trade ministerial positions for political support. Yet a small number of leaders in his party have been given cabinet positions. They include the former president's daughter, Puan Marani, who will direct 4 coordinating ministries, and former General Riamzard Ryokudu as defense minister. Critics say he has a questionable human rights record. Of 34 ministers in the new cabinet, 21 are either connected to a party or linked to top party officials. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Last June, Islamic State militants kidnapped more than 150 students from the city of Kobani in northern Syria. Many of those kidnapped were ethnic Kurds. The militants released most of the students several months later. One of those freed is a 16-year-old named Azad. He now lives in Turkey. Bob Doty has his story.
Azad said, "The militants seized him and the other students as they were returning home." He said the students had just finished taking their secondary school exams in the Syrian city of Aleppo. "We were scared," Azad said. "They had long beards. They told us, 'We will slaughter you, you infidels.' They asked us to pray and to make the ablutions. Some of us did not know how. They hit them and said, 'Why do you not know the ablutions?' Islamic State militants have executed thousands of people. The group has accused its victims of being infidels. In other words, for not following what the militants say is the true religion." Azan said, "For 3 months, the group beat the teenagers and threatened to execute them. They hit us and gave us religion lessons. They were taking medicine. Their eyes became red after that. They put bombs on themselves and said, 'We will go to heaven.' We cried and said, 'We want to go to our parents.' They hit us and said, 'Why are you crying for your parents? If you become Muslims and return to Kobani, you must kill your parents, because they are infidels,' remembered Azad." His mother, Baravan, said she and the other mothers appealed for their children's release. "It was very difficult, 3 months of tears and crying. We tried to see them, the Islamic State fighters. We went without the men, but they told us to leave. They said, 'If you don't go now, we will kill your children now.' We cried and cried," said Baravan. The militants released most of the children a few weeks ago. They sought to exchange the students for Islamic State fighters who had been captured. But Azad said he still has bad dreams about the experience. "Even after we move to Turkey, I am still afraid. I will always remember one of them. He came at 2 o'clock in the morning. He had a long beard. He told us, 'I will kill you all.' And then he left," he said. Azad passed his exams in Aleppo. He wants to be an engineer. He said he hopes to continue his education in Kobani someday. I'm Bob Doty.
We hope Azad is able to achieve his dream of becoming an engineer. That's all the time we have for today. Join us tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. The People's Republic of China established its current constitution more than 30 years ago. Now, the constitution is getting newfound attention under the leadership of Chinese President Xi Jinping. At a recent meeting, top-level officials spoke about building up the rule of law in China. The Communist Party has announced plans for a national day each year to celebrate the Constitution. And Chinese officials will promise to defend its rules when they take office. The Constitution was established in 1982. It became the law of the land when the Communist Party was opening up China economically. At the time, the country was still recovering from its deadly and socially divisive Cultural Revolution. Now, China is at a crossroads. Its years of strong economic growth have passed. The country is struggling with the huge changes that took place in recent years. Two results of those changes are rising levels of corruption and damage to the environment. China is seeking a new economic growth model. David Kelly is with the China Policy Research Group.
We're in a state of what we call trapeze economics. That is, the system has to let go of one growth model in the faith that the next growth model is going to be right where it's meant to be.
Mr. Kelly says building up the rule of law is important because investors need to have legal guarantees when doing business in China.
All of the mechanisms of a market economy are really needed more than ever. They were needed in 82, and that's why there were changes in 82, but they're needed more than ever now.
China is not a market-driven economy. It is, instead, an economy in which state-operated businesses enjoy the government's help. Government connections are important, and many Chinese want to work for state-owned businesses. David Kelly says this is something the government does not want.
They want to have global companies that are like Google or Apple. That doesn't happen without assurances that you can make it outside the state sector.
The Communist Party is also looking to change public opinion by placing attention on the rights of citizens. In a document released this week, the party talked about the need to strengthen citizens' guarantees to property rights, fair rules, and political rights. President Xi Jinping wants to see a number of changes in China by 2020. He aims to have a country in which the rule of law is in place and where trust in the legal system is continually growing. He says basic human rights will be respected and guaranteed. William Nee is a China expert with Amnesty International in Hong Kong. He says there is a hunger among the legal community and Chinese citizens for a rule of law that is clear and based on the Constitution.
So it does seem like they want to have some form of basic human rights to be implemented, and it seems like they want it to be done in the judiciary. At the same time, I think they want to kind of monopolize the process so that it's the party who's guaranteeing human rights and respecting human rights, and not as much putting mechanisms or restraints on political power, and especially the party's power.
President Xi has spoken about the importance of the Constitution before. Yet he has also taken action against his opponents and silenced critics. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Now the special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called Judge. It was written by Walter D. Edmonds. We will hear part one of the story today and part two next week. Here is Harry Monroe with our story.
When Charlie Haskell died, he left a wife and 9 children. They lived on a small piece of land in a house with 4 rooms. John was the oldest boy. He was 16 years old and tall for his age. After his father died, John's mother told him he would have to take care of the family. So John went into the cornfield behind the small house. There was very little corn and very many weeds. His family needed corn, and corn needed room to grow. John bent down and began pulling out the weeds. When John came in for supper that night, he told his mother that he had cleaned half the cornfield. She was surprised and immediately went outside to look at what he had done. While she was looking at the field, she remembered that her husband had sold some corn to Judge Doan. She also remembered that they had never collected the money for the corn. She told John to go to the judge's house right away to get it. John was afraid of Judge Doan. The judge was the richest man in town. He owned a lot of land, and everyone owed him money. His stone house looked like a palace. John went to the judge's house and knocked on the door. A servant opened it right away and brought John into the judge's office. Judge Doan was sitting at his desk. He was a very big man with a red face, long white hair, and serious blue eyes. John stood with his back to the door. He held his hat in both hands. "Hello, John," said the judge. "What do you want?" John told the judge about the money. "Oh, yes," said the judge. "I had forgotten about that. I'm sorry." He stood up and reached into his pocket. Slowly he pulled out a large brown leather wallet. He opened it and took out a new dollar bill and handed it to John. Then he sat down at his desk again. "How are you and your family doing?" he asked. "All right, sir," John said. "I wouldn't have bothered you about this money, but we needed it." "That is all right," the judge said slowly. "I should have remembered it. I didn't think of it, because your father owed me money. He owed me $40. John was so shocked, he couldn't think of anything to say. $40 was a fortune for him and his family. The judge looked at John for a few moments. "How old are you, boy?" he asked.
16, sir.
"And when do you think you will pay me back the $40 your father owed me?" he asked. John's face got very white.
"I don't know, sir," he whispered.
The judge stood up. "I hope you are not like your father," he said. "He was a lazy man who never worked hard." He held out his hand to the boy. "Good luck to you," he said,
as he shook John's hand. Then he walked with him to the front door and said good night. During the summer, John worked on other people's farms for 40 cents a day. At first, nobody wanted him. People remembered how lazy his father had been, and they gave the work to other boys. But John was a hard worker, and he began to get jobs. Soon he was working on other people's farms 6 days of the week. He worked on his own family's land every evening and all day Sunday. That summer, for the first time, the little farm had enough fruits and vegetables to feed John and his family. There was even enough for them to sell at the market. John used to wonder how his father had always found time to go fishing. John had very little time to fish that summer, and when he did have time to relax, he thought about the $40 he owed Judge Doan. Then he would go out and look for more work. At first, he gave all the money he earned to his mother. But then he began saving a few pennies every time he was paid. By the end of August, he had saved a dollar. As he held the money in his hand, he realized for the first time that someday he might be able to pay back all the money he owed to the judge. By the middle of October, John had saved $5 to give to the judge. So one night, after supper, he went back to the judge's big stone house. He found the judge sitting in his office. "Sit down, John," the judge said. "I know you have worked hard this summer. I'll be glad to help you if you need some money for the winter." John felt his face become very hot. "I didn't come here to ask for anything, Judge," he said. He pushed his hand deep into his pocket and pulled out his money. "I wanted to pay back some of the money I owe you. It is only $5, but here it is." And he handed the money to the judge. Judge Doan counted the money. Then he went to his desk and put the money in a drawer. "Where will you find work this winter, John?" "I don't know, sir." Several days later, John's mother asked him to go into town to buy cloth. She wanted to make some warm clothing for the children for the coming winter. On his way into town, John met Seth Whitefeather. Seth was an Indian who also worked on the farms during the summer. But in the winter, Seth traveled north and disappeared into the woods. As they walked toward the town, John told Seth that he had no work for the winter. Seth told John that he went into the woods every winter to hunt and trap wild animals for their fur. Seth said he earned $200 last winter. $200, John thought. He turned shyly to the Indian. "Could I come with you this year?" he asked. Seth looked at John without smiling. "Have you got a gun and some animal traps?" John shook his head. "No," he said. "How much would that cost?"
$75, the Indian replied. "If you can get those things, I will teach you how to catch the animals. I am leaving in 2 weeks." Only one person could help John. That night, he went to the judge's house. The house was dark, except for a light that was shining in the judge's office. John could see the judge sitting at his desk. The boy tapped at the window. Judge Doan opened it. When he saw the boy's thin face, he asked, "What do you want?"
"Please, Judge," said John, "could I talk to you?"
The judge shut the window and opened the front door. They went back to his office. "Be as quick as you can," the judge said. "It is late." John had never been so frightened in his life. He couldn't think or speak for a few moments. "Talk, boy," the judge barked at him. So John told him about Seth and the animal furs and asked the judge for the money.
$75, the judge said. "You're asking me to lend that much money to a 16-year-old boy just like that?"
"I could do it with $50, John said. "But if you think it is a bad idea, I won't bother you any more."
"Shut up," the judge said. "If I'm going to lend you money, I want to be sure you don't starve to death in the woods. Then I would never get my money back, would I?"
The judge looked hard at John for a few moments. "What about this Seth?" he asked. "Can you trust him?" John nodded his head. "He has always been nice to me," he said. The judge pulled out a piece of paper from his desk and wrote something on it. "Sign this," he said when he had finished writing. "It says you promised to pay me back $75 by next spring." John was embarrassed to tell the judge that he didn't know how to read or write.
"Put a mark at the bottom instead of your name," the judge said. "Here is the money. Don't lose it."
He walked John to the door and shook the boy's hand.
"Good luck. Come here as soon as you get back next spring."
You have heard part one of the American story, Judge. Your storyteller was Harry Monroe. The story was written by Walter D. Edmonds and adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Harcourt, Brace and Company published it in 1941 in Americans All, Stories of American Life. Edited by Benjamin Heydrich. This story is copyrighted. All rights reserved. This is Shirley Griffith.